Welcome to another podcast in Future Proofing Your Career. My name is Elise Stevens, and today I have the fantastic Susan Schwartz. Yay, Susan!
Oh, thank you.
Now, Susan, you bring about transformation in organizations, and you have a whole lot of tools in your toolbox to do that because, let's face it, it's not easy.
No, and it's not linear. You know, there's no one solution. It's not, put a book under your pillow and be a success the next day or swallow something.
But one of the tools you use a lot is emotional intelligence and equipping those around you with the skills that they need. And that is the topic of our podcast today.
Well, I'm excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So how I came to connect with you, this is a bit of confessional LinkedIn stalking here. I was looking to interview someone about emotional intelligence, and I saw something you'd written or some other event you went to, and I thought, you know, Susan's the person I should ask along. So,
well, thank you.
Thank you, LinkedIn. So, Susan, there is so much in the media about emotional intelligence. How do you define it?
Whew, that is a very good question because people come at it from many different perspectives. And what I am passionate about is the practicality of it. Because whether you're a technical team lead, a middle manager, or an executive, emotional intelligence can help you move your career forward because it's about balance, behaviors, and choices. And there was a study where the 21% top executives credited their success to emotional intelligence. That means 79% of the people are not taking advantage of the tools they have inside them. I was devastated. I saw that statistic last week, and I've been noodling over it, just surprised, because, you know, I've worked more at the project management level, but at the executive level, people will say, it's not personal, it's just business. I was in a meeting this morning where somebody said, there were a lot of people, so I didn't call them out. But that is a real cop-out, because business is personal. It's all about the relationships that you make and how you communicate. You know, why do customers choose you? And why do they come back and become a repeat customer? How do you retain customers? And that all comes back. You know, I used to say, oh, it's not about feelings, but it is about emotions. It's about what's inside your gut and what drives you. And that's why it's just so practical. It's a tool that you own, and you have some choices how you develop it.
I find, especially working in IT, that, you know, feelings.
I have an IT background. I know. I'm so glad you understand. I insult some people. I really don't mean to.
Oh, I do. But, you know, so we have this image, this very masculine image of what it means to be successful in IT. And, you know, we're very data orientated, you know, we're very quantitative, and you know, all this stuff. And it's just such nonsense, because I feel that a lot of the men in IT are actually very, very emotional. I have a theory that is probably going to shock people, but I actually think people purchase large software like ERPs and everything on very emotional basis.
Well, because they go on their gut. They go,
yes,
it's the whole user interface thing.
Yeah.
You know, like you know, maybe it's 2% faster, but if it's got a really cool user interface, you know, that's a toy.
So years and years ago, I was doing a short-term contract somewhere, and they were going to put in one of the two big ERPs, and they were like a medium-sized organization, and they were making that transition to be a larger organization. So they thought, oh, well, we'll get something to see us through, you know, yeah, whether it was right or wrong, you know, size-wise. And so they got this interim CIO in while I was there, and he was like, nah, 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 we're not doing that. You know, why would you want to do that? Bloody blah, blah, blah. So anyway, I left. And a couple of months later, I caught up with someone and they go, yeah, 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 he put the other one in.
Did they have any explanation? Was there a PS, like, why?
Oh, I know why he did it. Because he was comfortable with it. So all that bullshit about, you know, it's too big for this organization and all the things he used to derail the implementation of, you know, one of the top two, he was able to flick that around and put the other one in. And I was just like, if that's not an emotional decision, I don't know what is.
Well, and people, you know, I just mentioned the user interface and you were talking about what he was comfortable with. I mean, it is about passion.
And, yeah.
You know, and where software programmers about their code or engineers about their design, they work so, so hard and they care so much. I just ran a workshop for putting together sales presentations or just presentations in general. And there was a young engineer and she said she was there because her boss said she had to dumb down her presentation. She was devastated because she was in water resources. So it was really important to her. And if she made a mistake, people would die, you know, because you can't drink bad water. And she wanted the decision makers to know how much she cared and how important these numbers were. But, you know, the decision makers were county people on the government board making that decision. And they didn't get the equations. They didn't know the numbers. So, you know, we approached it from, well, that's your jargon. And they have a different education. And they use a different jargon. So, because they're your audience, you have to adapt your presentation and then have all that information in your back pocket if there is somebody who understands it and wants to know. But they're paying you to make that recommendation. You don't have to give them all the details.
And that's one of the key things about emotional intelligence, isn't it? It's about knowing you, but knowing your audience as well.
Absolute. Well said. That is perfect. That was one of my notes.
Oh, well, I'm glad
Thank you.
I think that emotional intelligence is sometimes used as a throwaway line. You know, you don't have very high emotional intelligence, do you? Or
But then people, that just squashes them down. And that's why I use that word balance. Because first of all, people, the diagnostic tool I use, there is an assessment tool, they won't assess anybody under the age of 18. And what their research has shown is that your emotional intelligence engagement, I like that word engagement, it's not a specific level, and it adapts depending on your mood or what's happened around you, those behaviors you're reacting to, and you peak at around 62. So I like to think of emotional intelligence as wisdom. You know, all those hard knocks that we get as we move forward. And when you get to age 62, that's where you come back to, you just sort of level out. You don't decrease, but you level out. And when I was taking my training to get my certification, they said, well, they don't really know why. And I was like, I know why, because by 62, you've been there, done that, and bought way too many t-shirts. And that's where the balance comes in, because we all have different strengths. And I'm sure lots of people have read Brené Brown about knowing your vulnerabilities. And now we're all talking about cognitive bias. So you don't want to get everybody who works just like you do. And, you know, if you have somebody that's a really good writer, but they don't think well on their feet, they're kind of shy, they don't like to present. Well, what about those people who are really good on their feet, that love to be in front of people, love to present, and they can't put two words together? You know, their emails are three paragraphs long and you read them and you still don't know what they're saying. So you have to pick up the phone and call them. And that's a defense mechanism because they want to talk to you. So do you see that balance? It's not exactly emotional intelligence, but it's tangible. So if you put the two of them together, you're going to have a really good proposal writer and a really good presenter. And as they work together, some of their skills might just rub off on the other. And that's what makes a really strong team. And that's what, from an executive point of view, your profits are going to be there. From a manager's point of view, you get a stronger team.
I still don't see teams really embracing the skills of the individual. I still feel that in some respects, they want people to be, you know, exact copies of each other sometimes.
Yes. And then you get mistakes.
Yeah.
Well, in coming at it from the other side, I had a manager once, which only lasted 4 months. He wanted everybody to be a little clone of him because he felt that what he did was perfect. And if all of his staff would do exactly behave and work and provide the same, they would all provide the same product. And he wanted little bitty clones. There was no innovation, no creativity, even though they billed themselves as an innovative company. And what happened is he had a really low retention rate. He could not keep staff. I think the longest tenure was like 8 months. And so that's when you want to call me in because you have this low retention rate. You know, a lot of people like stats, the Gallup organization was looking at workplace behavior and environments, and they discovered that 94% of the workplace population either had left a job or wanted to leave a job because of their direct manager, because they didn't feel respected, you know, a lot of different reasons. And so that manager, it's not that they were being bad managers on purpose. They just were, you know, very often they were promoted because they're technical experts without any regard to their people / human management skills. People have been suggesting I call them human management skills. And they're really smart and they don't even know what to do as a manager. So they end up micromanaging all these people. Because that's what they do best. They're so comfortable. So, and that's why they want everybody just like them, because they were promoted because of their expertise and how well they did that job by themselves, as opposed to looking out and seeing who else can help them be even better. How can you make this team stronger? And when I work with team or these individuals, can't lead a team of one. Leadership is not a solo sport. And so if you have a team, you know, how do sports teams work? You know, you think about lacrosse and baseball and rugby. You know, each position has their expertise. And, you know, when children are coming up in the ranks, some people are good hitters in baseball, or I guess in cricket, they, you know, they're good hitters, and other people are good fielders. And you can't, if you only had good hitters on a team, what about the fielders? And so, you know, looking at some of these sports teams, that's how business teams should work.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think that, let's talk about technical experts and emotional intelligence. And I feel like, especially IT technical experts, I feel like they're kind of like a lost tribe with regard to emotional intelligence. And the reason I say that is because I don't think that they get, I think maybe things are changing, but in the past, definitely, there's been very little or no attempt to try and help them be more emotionally intelligent.
I totally agree. And it might, I think there's two thoughts that are kind of related but different. Is so much of what they do, when I think about IT, I often think about software programmers. But, you know, the people who design all those, the CPUs and all those circuit boards, they tend to work alone. And they, you know, it's a linear path because they're working alone. A lot of times, you know, software programmers, when I was very young and starting out, somebody, you know, they just liked to work alone. They were considered social misfits. And so they didn't have to deal with people. They could just focus on the code. And so they didn't have that chance to mature in the workplace and figure out what are acceptable, not only acceptable, but what are positive behaviors. And then I have seen some changes in the last 10 years as we've brought agile methodology into the software workplace. And all of a sudden you have teams of people. And there was a software project I was working on, a training team. And what happened was the software programmers were off in their corner and people would say, well, what's going on? How's your progress? And they were like, oh, we'll get there. It's due. I have till October 15th. It'll be done. Well, October 15th came around. It was 9 months after they were given the project and their software program did not do what the customer wanted. Nobody, 9 months wasted. Just think of all that money. Whereas the power in everybody, there's no, I tried to learn about Agile and I've learned some great stuff, but my biggest learning is people interpret it just like emotional intelligence in different ways. But what is the same is you divide it up into small chunks. And so you get a daily, you know, at least a weekly, if not a daily update. Are we on track? Are we on target? Do we all have the same vision? And so you're going to finish a project instead of 9 months with one single person working on it. You might have a team of five or six and be able to get it done in 5 or 6 months. You know, so people will liken it that you could have nine women, but you couldn't make a baby in 1 month with nine women. So it's not exactly a one for one, but if you're working on a software project and you bring together a team of people, you're going to do a faster, more effective, you know, more efficient type of job. And so I think that was the biggest shift, was getting, breaking down those silos and trying to get them to work together. And the second part would be once they started working together, they kind of compete with each other for who is the best technically, which is probably another thing behind Agile, even though it's supposed to be peer and everybody has a voice. I was a technology person. I oversaw 26 technology trainers. They were all cowboys. They trying to be the best out of, you know, their peers. So when they do get promoted to manager, their egos are just off the roof because they're so good technically. And it's not that they don't deserve the accolades, but they're getting promoted to a position that requires different skill sets. I worked with a project management certification program. I put together the emotional intelligence for leaders. That was an elective, and it turned out to be everybody's favorite elective. So we tried to create a second curriculum, an advanced project manager curriculum, with all of these human behaviors. And, you know, how do you manage them? We couldn't get anybody to sign up. You know, we had two or three. And I called some of the people who expressed a good, strong interest. And they were the response slightly different, but the absolute consistent message was, my boss will only pay for technical training. Soft skills, they're easy, buy a book. And so I did, I wrote a book. I just got mad and wrote a book, and it's called A Project Manager's Guide to Becoming a Leader. And the overall title is Creating a Greater Whole, because the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And, you know, people, the feedback I get is that it's written to the right audience and it's easy to read. And people have told me they've started putting a lot of those practices into place in their workplace. You know, it was written so you could learn something and then take it forward and apply it immediately.
And that's what people need. You know, the technical profession in IT, project managers, engineers and everything, you know, I find it difficult. You know, I need to be more emotionally intelligent. Well, what does that mean? Or there's a job ad, must have emotional intelligence. And it's like, I am very emotionally intelligent, you know.
But we all are. It's just we're engaged in different ways, you know. It's like a normal curve, the statistical people, and it's the rubric that they've chosen is 100 is the top of that curve. So we were all taught in school that 94 to 100 was an A. Well, now when you start to look at emotional intelligence, you have to shift your mindset because 100 means average. It means that 50% of the people are less engaged than you are and 50% of the people are more engaged. And that depending where your engagement falls, you sort of balance yourself out. So my least engaged trait is impulse control. My most engaged trait is reality testing. I've shared that with a couple of friends because I just couldn't wrap my head around it. And I don't take a lot of risks. You know, my risks are thought out. And then I realized it was accurate because my very favorite job was as a product manager. And what that meant was I got to think of all these great ideas. But I was a startup. I had 90 days to build it and 90 days to make a profit. So even though I had all these great ideas, I had to engage my reality testing check and make sure that it was small enough, targeted enough to make in 90 days, and that there was a market that really wanted to buy it, and that we had a plan to get it out there. And so I realized that balance, having that low engagement towards impulse control might seem like a problem. On the other hand, I balanced it out. So it's kind of like thinking about the old, your mother used to say, if everybody else jumps off a bridge, will you jump off a bridge too? So I might think about jumping off that bridge, but I know it'll hurt, so I don't. So just because you think it doesn't mean you have to act on it. And that's where behaviors and choices come in. Your behavior is the only behavior you can control. You can't control anybody else's. And that's where the emotion and emotional intelligence comes in, is because it's that gut feeling. And if you recognize what your hot button is, then you choose how to react. You know, okay, Susan, Fred just said something stupid. Don't get angry at him. Take a breath, and now let's make this positive and turn it into a constructive. Ask him a question. Don't tell him he's stupid. You know, just, you know what I mean? Ease him into it. How many of us just get mad and either stop conversing or yell at them or say, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard? When you're engaged, when you're paying attention to your surroundings, you're observing that behavior. And then you get to make a choice what's best for you and the team, like in those technical leads. You know, you get to choose, do you react and splinter everybody away? Or do you ask a question and continue the conversation, getting everybody involved? And maybe Brad or Sharon or whoever it is, as you ask questions, you haven't exiled them. You haven't told them they're stupid. You just lead them down the path that they might think of another solution. It's just being engaged and really paying attention. So that I just saw a great quote this week. It said, adapt what is useful, reject what is useless, and add something positive. And that's the core of emotional intelligence. And I loved it. I wish I could take credit for thinking it up, but I'm sure it's one of those adages that have been passed around.
If someone wants to hone their EI skills, what do they need to do to get started?
I think it's a matter of being present in the moment with the people you're around and paying attention. So as you pay attention to the people around you, you'll start to recognize the strengths and vulnerabilities and how they might balance each other out. You also need to pay attention to their motivations. That's part of behavior, why you might act one way in a certain situation. And so when we talk about emotional intelligence and really strong leaders bring people together and into a constructive working. So it's really all about diversity and inclusion. And I, you know, it's not just about the color of your skin. And in the workplace, it's different people have different working styles, different communication styles. And so, yes, we want to pay attention to gender and skin color and language, but it extends to everybody. You know, people with privilege all have different work styles, all have different communication styles. And it's making that whole package come together. And that's where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts comes back, because everybody has something unique about them and something they can bring to the team. And you know what? If there is someone who doesn't have anything to add, you might be doing them the biggest favor ever by helping them find another place in the organization where they can truly, truly help. And you don't have to be cold, but maybe they're unhappy also. So do you help them get trained? Do you help them find a better position? Do you maybe switch their role in the working team to do something they're more comfortable with? So, you know, it's having those conversations and really paying attention and being present so that you're not that manager that just points fingers. You know, you hear horror stories about managers that communicate via email and they never go to visit the remote working team. They just know all the answers and they do it all via email. There's never two-way conversation. I can see you laughing. I'm sure you have you worked for somebody like that?
Oh, yeah. People that are not very self-aware and they live in their own bubble.
Exactly.
And they've got no idea. And this, but they've got this perception of you or of other people, and it's like,
and they're the manager. They have a title, therefore you should pay attention and listen to them. And you know, and I was doing some research, and there's all this research out there that says when that middle management, you know, go from being a worker bee, you get first level, second level, and you're a really good manager. You involve everybody. You have empathy. That's one. Everybody likes working on your team. You get great reviews, all those 360s. And then you get promoted to like VP or senior VP. And they give you a key to that proverbial executive suite. You have that private, beautiful washroom. And it turns out that those people, even the ones that got it when they were middle managers, they take on the persona of that C-suite. It's like it's a private club. And people who once really got it, all of a sudden they become the experts and they start only speaking one way. And they got promoted to the high-level executive, so obviously their way must be the best way. So everybody should listen to them because they're the expert.
Well, it's been lovely chatting with you today, Susan.
Well, thank you. This has been fun. I really appreciate your perspective and what you've shared with me and your interest in emotional intelligence.
It's a topic that is very interesting, and I think that it does get bandied around a lot, and you know, people are skeptical about it. I know because people have told me.
And you and I work with people who are very, very practical. I've been a participant in several workshops where they say emotional intelligence and they're digging deep inside of you, but they do it with a color wheel. And so you're looking at this color wheel and trying to decide what color you are at, you know, under certain circumstances. So, you know, you come away, can you see asking a hardware engineer to decide if he's lilac or peach?
No.
I don't mean to be disrespectful. I think there's a place for all of this. But when we're talking about technical people about a very a salt of the earth type of people that write software, that make widgets, that, you know, they're very practically focused. And I think if you approach them talking about balancing skills, observing behaviors, and giving them the power of making a choice, because so many people feel like they don't have choices. You know, they're working to pay the mortgage and they're working to feed the kids. But even if, you know, we all have to work to pay, you know, pay the rent. But if you feel like you have some control in the workplace, it's not quite so bad. And that's what emotional intelligence gives you, is it gives you power over your behavior. You might need to adapt it because of the people you work with. But when you're paying attention to yourself and your, even how I react, if my boss yells at me, I have a choice how I react. And making that choice of how you react to that ranting and raving boss, which I'm sure we've all worked for, that gives you a choice. You don't have to think about the ranting and raving. You can think about the power that you own, and your choice is how you react to that person.
Well, thank you very much, Susan, for your time today.
Well, thank you. I hope I haven't run over.
No, it's been fabulous. That ends another podcast from Future Proof Your Career.